Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper on some things that we touched on earlier in the week. On Wednesday, we spoke with Jacob Vigdor, a professor of public policy and economics at Duke University. Vigdor discussed his research that he said found that gaining access to computers and the internet didn't necessarily improve student test scores in low-income areas and could actually make them worse.
While the adults in the room look at the computer and see something that is going to help these kids do their schoolwork, learn faster, learn better, be smarter people when they're adults, a child looks at that same computer and sees something that they use to play games, they use to communicate with their friends. Using it for schoolwork is not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, many of our listeners thought that that argument missed the point, even if it was accurate. Many of you told us that, yes, simply giving computers and web access to low-income students will not necessarily improve academic achievement. There are, however, efforts by organizations like Computers for Youth that not only give computers to low-income students, but train them and their families how to navigate the technology and use specialized educational software to improve their learning environment at home. My next guest, Mark Malaspina, is the Chief Officer of Operations and Strategic Partnerships at Computers for Youth, and he joins us now briefly. Hi, Mark. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
Since 1999, your organization has worked with more than 20,000 families in five different cities, New York, Philadelphia, Atlanta, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, by way of background. How do you choose what schools to go into, and what's your goal?
So our goal is to help low-income students do better in school by improving their learning environment at home. And we do that by partnering with high-poverty middle schools in those five cities. We also work with 35 affiliates in 20 states around the country. When we choose schools, we do it on the basis of their commitment to technology integration and instruction, as well as their commitment to parental involvement.
And how do you do that? What does the actual training entail?
So the training that we do involves several components. When we work with a school, we partner with them to do outreach to their sixth grade families and bring the families into the schools on Saturdays for what we call family learning workshops. At the family learning workshops, we provide English and Spanish training to families in which they actually have hands-on experience with what we call the home learning centers, which is the computers with the educational software. They then provide technical support through the life of the program for the families. As well, we also provide professional development for the teachers in the schools about how to best integrate technology in instruction and establish the school-to-home connection.
And how do you measure success?
So success is measured in several ways. We've done a number of studies, both internally and with partner organizations, to evaluate the impact of our program on student achievement. One of the leading studies that we did was with the Educational Testing Service, which evaluated the effect of the program on students' math scores and found that our program explained 14% of the positive variance of students' scores on a year-over-year basis, and that was particularly related to the students' use of the internet at home as well as the use of the computer for what's called self-directed learning.
So do you think the Duke study just got inaccurate results, or do you think they were measuring the wrong thing?
Yeah, we really think that the question that they were answering wasn't the relevant question. They seem to be asking the question whether the simple presence of home technology by itself would make a difference in students' learning. And frankly, I don't think anyone would expect that the simple presence of any object, whether it's a computer, a musical instrument, would make a compelling impact on kids. The really relevant question is whether home technology combined with engaging educational software, family training, professional development for schools would make a compelling difference.
Although in the real world, it's great that a group like yours, Computers for Youth, is out there doing what it's doing, but the vast majority of people in any income group are not going to have access to that kind of intensive, kind of positive use training.
We think that increasingly there are real opportunities to broaden the kind of program that CFY is doing. One really interesting point about the study that you mentioned is that in a footnote, they mention a Texas program that actually involved multiple components, really a holistic program. And unfortunately, the study's authors really underplayed the positive impacts of that program. What that program found was that students in the program had an 8% of a standard deviation increase in reading scores, a 20% increase in in math scores. And the study actually just says in a footnote, evaluation of the Texas program is complicated by the fact that the intervention involved more than providing laptops to students. We think that the Texas program, the CFY program, and a number of other programs around the country have a lot of legs and can really deliver this kind of benefit to low-income students quite broadly.
You know, one of the arguments that we heard in the clip from Jacob Vigdor is that adults think of computers as learning tools. A child looks at that same computer and sees something that they use to play games or communicate with their friends. But one of the other strains of criticism of his appearance that we got from a lot of listeners is that those things are positive and, in a way, educational too, because you get certain kinds of experiences from playing games. Now, it's going to depend to some degree on which games, but also the socialization of communicating with their friends, which involves some amount of literacy, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really are interested in this question of what kind of educational software is both engaging for the students and promotes learning across the different subject areas. For the last many years, we've had a student software team, which is composed of New York City middle school students, which is involved in a very intensive evaluation of new software titles. And what we've found through that evaluation process, and then, you know, actually including the software on our computers and online for kids, is that kids really do get energized and engaged by software that promotes learning. I'll give you a couple of examples if you're interested. One of the titles that we're using this year is called Scratch. It's produced by the MIT Media Lab, and it involves computer programming for kids that allows them to create games, other kinds of simulations on their own. We also have a program called Real Lives, which allows children to simulate growing up in one of 190 countries around the world. It includes demographic and other kinds of data about what it would be like in those countries. And we really find that kids and their parents get really engaged around programs like that, and there's clear learning outcomes that happen as a result.
So before you go, just tell our listeners where they might be able to take advantage of a Computers for Youth program. Do you have things going on in our area?
Absolutely. We're really excited about a program that will be launching this fall, led by two city agencies, the New York City Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications and the New York City Department of Education. CFY is the lead program partner in that implementation, and it's funded by the U.S. Department of Commerce. This program will serve about 18,500 families over the next 2 years in selected New York City middle schools across the city.
And how can people get in touch with you?
People can get in touch with us via our website. It's www.cfy.org. We look forward to hearing from people for volunteer opportunities that we have, as well as employment opportunities, et cetera.
CFY.org for Computers for Youth. Mark Malaspina, Chief Officer of Operations and Strategic Partnerships at Computers for Youth. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday, so let's revisit the story of the week. Steven Slater, the JetBlue flight attendant who cursed out a passenger, grabbed two brewskis and exited down the plane's emergency slide on Monday. We discussed the incident. On that day's show, we collected your most memorable I quit stories. We also tried to enter a new term into the lexicon, deploy the slide, for whenever you quit your job in a blaze of glory. So, okay, Ben Zimmer, on language columnist for the New York Times. Did it work? Did we coin a new phrase?
Well, deploy the slide was a good phrase, but a lot of people had the same idea or a similar idea. We saw a lot of new phrases being coined in the wake of the Stephen Slater incident, and some of them were very similar. So there was a lot of talk about hitting the slide, for instance. That became a very popular one. Deploying the slide, I've seen that too, but I think hit the slide might actually, if there's going to be a phrase that comes out of this whole event that we remember and that we use, that might be the one. I just saw a blogger on the conservative website Red State wondering if White House spokesman Robert Gibbs is about to hit the slide based on some of his recent comments. There's speculation that he's going to hightail it out of there. And
he even made a joking reference to that himself after he got in trouble for one of his comments the other day. And fair enough, today's Urban Dictionary word of the day on that site is hit the slide. So I don't know, is there a way to know when one is a consensus pick, and how much does Twitter affect the world of language?
Well, Twitter has an increasing role to play in the popularization of these types of words and phrases. So it's a way for something like this to go viral, to really catch on, and Twitter is certainly helping with that. And so I've seen hitting the slide on Twitter a lot, as well as some other words and phrases formed directly from Slater's name. So you can make a verb out of his name to say, I'm going to Slater on out of here, or you could say you're going to pull a Slater, or you could go Slater, which is sort of like going postal, only a little less violent.
We did see deploy the slide as a trending topic on Twitter for a while, so we got a little action there. It seemed like every other tweet on Twitter was about Stephen Slater in one way or another. As a linguist, does it give you a thrill to watch new words develop in real time like that?
Absolutely. It's always exciting to be able to see something like this from the beginning. And Twitter and other social media and blogs and so forth are really allowing us to see that whole process take shape and see how these things spread exactly, how what's often called a meme can get spread over the web just from one person to the other. And we see this happen very often with big pop cultural moments like we had this week with Stephen Slater.
By the way, do you like punny headlines like we see constantly in the tabloids and as we saw in the Post and the Daily News on this story, like Planiac and Wingnut?
Right. New York Post seemed like they were really trying to find some great new term to refer to Slater, and obviously they don't seem to think of him as much of a folk hero as some other people, and so they used Wingnut and Planiac, that sort of typical tabloid headline talk, rather than something that might catch on virally. Another interesting description of Stephen Slater, which he in fact used for himself, was Bag Nazi. This, of course, referring to how in not just in this incident, but in past incidents, he's maybe mixed it up a little with passengers over making sure that that their overhead bags were properly stowed. And so he himself called himself a bag Nazi, which following after the soup Nazi on Seinfeld and various other types of things like grammar Nazis that people talk about.
Although I generally think that Nazi should be excluded from use in the English language, except when talking about certain Germans in the first half of the 20th century. And for the record, I mean, we do realize that Stephen Slater, folk hero on the one hand, is having his story questioned on the other hand as to whether he actually was ever assaulted by a passenger. We're also reading conflicting reports about whether he grabbed one beer or two. So rest assured, listeners, our crack research team is on it, and we will keep you updated. But can you imagine the headlines, in all seriousness, Ben, if this flight attendant happened to be Arab or Muslim or South Asian looking, would he be a tabloid folk hero today?
That's out
of your language, Ken, I realize, but...
No, it's interesting. I mean, there's something that people see as identifiable, and perhaps, you know, I won't speculate in terms of ethnicity and that sort of thing, but I will say that his name, Slater, seems to lend itself well to these Slaterisms, and sometimes people with more complicated names, I'm thinking, for instance, of Rod Blagojevich, don't necessarily lend themselves to becoming sort of part of the lexicon as well, just because their name might be a little difficult to say.
Blago in the tabloids.
Right, and it's easier just to say Blago.
And you might want to look at the black-oriented Root magazine online. which declares Slater an honorary African American today for expressing the working class rage that so many black people feel and acting out many black Americans' fantasies of quitting with a flourish. But the Root also wonders what the public and media reaction would be if Slater actually was black. Would he have been seen as a hero or a threat for kind of, you know, going off the rails on the job in the confines of an airplane? So we leave it there, unless you want to say one other thing in reaction to that, with Ben Zimmer, on language columnist for The New York Times.
Well, I'll just say that it does require some kind of identifiability where you really say, I could be in that position. And then from that, that can enter the language to say, I want to hit the slide too, but I'm not, I don't have the guts to do it.
Yes. Who do we see as us? Ben, thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Paige Cowett, Rachel Senator, and James Hover produced this program. We had intern help today from Janet Kim, and our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer.